You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. Today we're going to be talking about water and conflict in two very different places. One is specifically about the water and who it belongs to and who should be able to access it. And the other water, well, actually it's ice. And the issue is the resources underneath it and who they belong to. As the world population grows, obviously we use more water. Water scarcity is a serious problem for many countries. There's no rocket science there. A classic example is the Nile River, which runs through 11 countries in the region, but is the primary source of water for two of them, Egypt and the Sudan. You guessed it, there's conflict over the water. Who needs how much and who's entitled to have what? Another potential conflict is brewing in the north, in the Arctic. This one is about what is under the frozen water we call ice and who owns it. The major players are Russia and the United States, and predominantly its NATO allies. What's at stake is the potential of 1,670 trillion cubic feet of natural gas and 90 billion barrels of oil. And right now, Russia has the advantage. But who has the advantage in the debate over Scottish independence? Let's find out as we welcome back Counterpoint regular Brendan O'Neill. Brendan, welcome back.
Hi.
Can we start by talking about Scotland and the desire of some Scottish people to be independent, to leave the United Kingdom? What's going on there?
It's very interesting because if you look at where this whole discussion came from, it hasn't come from a groundswell of popular demand for Scottish independence. There hasn't been any kind of Rob Roy-style movement to split Scotland away from the rest of the United Kingdom. It's kind of come about almost accidentally. So you have the Scottish National Party, which is now the ruling party in Scotland's kind of devolved assembly, who have kind of tried to squeeze this onto the agenda. And you have David Cameron on the other side in London saying, oh, please stay with us, don't go away. And it's kind of like a discussion between two politicians, effectively, rather than being this kind of mass nationalist movement to split away. And what's interesting is if you look at polls, they show that Scottish people are very lukewarm about Scottish independence. There's not a great deal of enthusiasm for it. So it looks very much to me not like a great, proud nationalist movement, but more like a kind of accidental breaking apart of the United Kingdom. So I must say that I find it quite sad, actually, that this is happening.
But aren't there some people who say, oh, those polls, they don't really tell the truth. There's a much stronger feeling towards this than the polls really say. I suppose we might expect the pro-independence people to say that, but do you think there's a chance it's true?
Well, some people do say that, and there may well be some truth that there are some sections of Scotland that are very passionate about this. I'm sure that's true. But, you know, I know a lot of Scottish people and I know a variety of Scottish people and some of them are pro-independence and some of them are against it. But none of them are particularly moved by this issue. And in fact, a lot of Scottish people you talk to will say that it's a distraction. It's a distraction from the serious problems that Scottish people face, like recession and a lack of political direction and other issues like that. So certainly, I have not seen any great enthusiasm for it. You never see protests. You never see large gatherings of Scottish people saying, we want freedom, we want it now. You never see anything like that. And also, I don't buy the idea that what the Scottish National Party is demanding is proper independence, because what they're currently saying is they want to keep the sterling currency, so they want to keep British currency when they become supposedly independent.
That's so, not likely, though, is it? I mean, haven't the British said, look, if you want to go, go, but you're not getting the pound if you do?
Exactly. The Bank of England has said that it would be very difficult for them to keep the pound, which caused a huge discussion over here about the Bank of England supposedly using the politics of fear to try to keep Scotland as part of the United Kingdom. But also, Scotland is very interesting because the Scottish National Party also says that one of the first things it will do when it becomes independent is to join the European Union. And of course, you know, we know from recent history that nations that join the European Union are far from being properly independent, because Brussels can often tell you what to do, how to think, how to organise your political affairs.
How
curvy your bananas can be, all sorts of kind of diktats. So it's almost
going too far there, aren't you? Surely they don't.
There have been controversies in recent years about what fruit can look like and how fresh it must be and all sorts of bizarre stuff. So it's like Scotland is on the one hand saying, yes, we want to be independent. On the other is saying, well, we are going to subsume ourselves into the European Union. So I don't buy the idea that this is really about independence. And the thing I find most interesting is that the Scottish National Party, led by Alex Salmond, obviously doesn't trust Scottish people to actually be independent, because this is one of the most petty authoritarian parties in Western Europe at the moment. It has brought in minimum alcohol pricing to try and prevent people from buying too much booze. It has banned people from singing particular songs and chanting particular things at football games. It was a pioneer of smoking bans. It is a very nannying, interfering political party. So something doesn't measure up. The idea that the Scottish National Party wants its people to be independent, coupled with the fact that it is continually telling them how to live their lives, I don't buy this independence thing. There's something else going on.
Well, we might have to come back to that, but I've got a sneaking suspicion that Scottish people loved Mel Gibson in Braveheart, and since then some of them have gone crazy and think, you know, they're going to come running down out of the mountains in a kilt and scream, stand together and fall in a big heap, because they're going to have to pay a portion of the UK debt. They'll have to take that on. They're going to get the EU, and they're going to lose some control of their affairs anyway to the EU if they join it. So, you know, there's a bit of negotiating available, I suppose. We haven't mentioned this. UK bases that are up in Scotland in defence terms might make a bit of a difference. But, look, it doesn't seem it's going very far, does it?
No.
Okay, well, look, let's move to France. Oh, the affairs of the heart. They're always there in France, aren't they? Probably everywhere. But, you know, there's a first lady who is so shocked she goes to hospital. I must say, I did think, well, why didn't you know? But plenty of people don't. I mean, who does know? Anyway, the French community apparently a bit annoyed with her not moving out and giving up entitlements. They think, well, he's chosen someone else. Move on, sister.
Yes, to non-French people, I'm sure this all looks a bit peculiar, because they do things a bit differently in France. I mean, it's generally accepted in France that presidents will have affairs and flings. It's also widely accepted in France that people's private lives should remain private, which I think is actually quite an admirable thing. So there's a lot of shock in France that people are daring to talk about this affair, that the European and international press are daring to cover it on their front pages. So France does things a bit differently to most other countries. And one consequence of that is that a lot of the attacks have been on the First Lady. Firstly, as you say, for not realizing that this was happening, or apparently not realizing this was happening. And secondly, for not falling into line and doing what she's supposed to do, which is supposedly to step aside a little bit and let this new lady come to the fore if Hollande wants her to. But another discussion that has come up, which I think is really interesting, is the question of whether we need first ladies. The question of whether in America and France and other countries where there has been this tradition of having a president on one side and a first lady standing next to him, whether that isn't just extremely outdated and possibly quite sexist, because it turns the wife of a politician into this kind of piece of arm candy whose job is just to march silently next to her husband and smile and wave. And I think there could be something in that. I think it does feel odd in the 21st century to have this institution of the First Lady who kind of represents the feminine side of a nation. So it's thrown up an interesting debate about whether that whole institution is questionable today.
Well, I did read in an article almost the flip side of that, for the sake of argument, using quite vernacular language, that said, look, First Lady, what a great job this is. All you have to do is, and I'm quoting the article, shag the guy who's in charge or the person who's in charge, and you get this great job with great entitlements, and, you know, good luck go to you. I don't know if it was a French person who wrote that article, but what do you say to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a cushy number, well, a nice life for anyone who kind of falls into it. To me, it's reminiscent of the kept woman, you know, a woman who makes her fortune via her man. And I don't particularly have a problem with that. You know, I'm all in favour of women choosing what to do with their lives and working or not working or going out and having a career or staying at home and being mums. That's all fine. But the problem, I think, with the institution of the First Lady is it's a very public institution and it sends a message of some sort to the population. And I think one of the messages it sends is that it's the responsibility of a wife to stand by her husband, and in this French case, not only to stand by her husband, but also dutifully to walk away quietly when her husband decides that he's had enough. So I do think that in France and other countries, there is an issue with the First Lady, particularly now that obviously more women are being involved in politics. And you look across to America where Hillary Clinton is agitating to become the next president, and you do wonder what will happen with Bill, you know, the first husband, or how will that work and what will it mean? So I do think there are, maybe not right now, but certainly over the next 10 or 20 years, as the gender makeup of politics continues to change, there is going to have to be some serious questions asked about this institution and about the way that the women in it are treated.
Mm. Is there some lack of sympathy for her? Because after all, she's not the first. I mean, she moved in on someone else. There might be people who say, well, look, sweetheart, you moved in and someone got brushed aside. Now's your time. And if you're unwilling to go, bad luck. What was good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yes, I think that's right. And also, she's had a fairly hard time establishing herself as the First Lady as well, because
I think you're trying to say she hasn't made herself popular.
Yes, she's never made herself particularly popular, especially in comparison with the last First Lady, Carla Bruni, who was extremely popular in Europe and in France and outside of France. Even though her husband, Sarkozy, wasn't always particularly popular, Carla Bruni was. So Hollande's wife has had a tough act to follow. She never really established herself in the hearts and minds of French people. And then she responded in a way that French people considered to be odd to the news of this affair. So all those things combined mean that she has had a fairly rough time of it. But I think the fact that a discussion has come out not only about her, but about the institution she works in, it's probably quite healthy, and it'd be interesting to see where it goes next.
Mm. Be interesting to see if they have a first bloke. I mean, we've had one in Australia.
Mm. Yeah,
former Prime Minister Gillard was living with her partner. We may see a first bloke in the United States, and if they ever get to that point in France, we might get a clearer understanding of whether people really do think that whoever is president needs a partner, or whether it is particularly seen as a female thing. All right, well, look, let's leave France behind and move on to Denmark and Sweden, where recently, I understand, people are getting hot under the collar about circumcision and arguing the case that unless there was a medical reason for it, it should not be allowed to proceed. Mm. Some people say this is really just some hidden sort of anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim feeling coming out through the medical profession. Other people say, no, there's no medical reason to do this, and the child has a right to have nothing like this done to them until they're able to give consent. Mm. Now, where do you stand on that sort of continuum of thought from one side to the other?
I find myself very worried about the anti-circumcision feeling that is spreading across large parts of Europe, because not only have we recently had this vote of the medical councils in Denmark and Sweden, but also last year in Germany, a court decreed that circumcision was cruel behaviour. It wasn't a binding judgment, but it did say that it thought circumcision was cruel and should be stopped. And other countries in Europe have also had similar discussions and developments about wanting at some point to ban circumcision. And the reason I find this worrying is because in Sweden and Denmark, the medical councils have said that children should only be circumcised at the age of 12 when they can give some form of consent. But of course, in the Jewish religion, a boy has to be circumcised on the eighth day of his life. So what you're effectively saying is that you can no longer have Jewish boys. You can no longer have what Jews consider to be a Jewish child. So the repercussions of this on religious freedom and the repercussions of it on Jewish traditions particularly are really worrying, I think. And I think it shows how cavalier lots of modern Europe has become about religious freedom and about very old, long-standing traditions that communities have cleaved to. I'm worried about the direction this is moving in.
Well, I must say, I read some of the articles associated with this and thought, you know, what is going on here? Haven't these people got bigger things to worry about than telling parents how they should bring their children up? I mean, if there was a serious case that circumcision was very, very bad for a child and, you know, led to whatever nasty things, you might be interested in entertaining the case. But since I don't understand that there is that sort of argument, it's more a case of the human right of the child to choose later in life. But people who advocate that seem to ignore the rights and obligations of parents to bring up children according to their value system, to be themselves and live in their families in whatever way they want. And this is yet again the state or the judiciary or outside organisations saying, hey, we know better than you, the parents, and I'm not sure they do.
You're absolutely right. What's very striking is that all these people who are against circumcision will say, but it's fine to have non-religious circumcision when it's necessary for the child's health or when a doctor says it's best. So obviously they recognise that circumcision itself is not particularly dangerous or problematic because they're willing to agree it in some cases. What they're saying is that ritual circumcision or circumcision done for religious or traditional beliefs is a problem. So they're explicitly trying to criminalise effectively what parents think and what parents want, not the act itself, but the driving force behind it, the sentiments behind it. And you're right, this really represents an attempted clampdown by state officials on the rights of parents to bring up their children in their faith system, to inculcate their children with their beliefs and with their outlook and with their traditions, which I think is a really important right for parents and families and communities to enjoy. And what I find really, really interesting about this discussion is the language that's used, the really horrible language. You know, circumcision is now referred to by some people as mutilation and cutting and assault and harm. And I think what we're seeing is the use of children's rights as a cover to attack long-standing adult freedoms and religious freedoms. And I think people need to be a lot more sceptical about the use of the term children's rights to launch an assault on freedom itself.
Well, speaking of racial undertones, what's happening in Europe at the moment with the level of anti-Semitism across Europe?
Nothing good. It's a worrying situation, particularly in France, but also beyond France. You know, in France they have a rather gruff comedian there called Dudon, who is a comedian born in France of Cameroonian descent, who has made international headlines recently with his anti-Semitic humour and his Holocaust denial and his development of something called the Canel, which is a kind of inverted Nazi salute. And this Canel has become extremely popular amongst French youth. And on social networking websites, you will often see young French people doing the Canel outside Auschwitz, outside the Jewish school in France where three children were shot a couple of years ago. So it's a very explicitly anti-Semitic gesture, and it's becoming more and more popular. And what was really striking to me is that 2 weeks ago in France, there was a march of 20,000 people against Hollande. It was called a Day of Rage against Hollande. But then halfway through the demonstration, they all started chanting, Jews, Jews, out of France. And when you see that in a modern country in the 21st century, it's alarming. It's a terrible thing to see. And I think across Europe, in various different ways, as a consequence of a number of different things, I think one impact is the increasing trendiness of anti-Israel politics, which is now very trendy amongst Western youth. The impact of radical Muslim sentiment, which has grown in intensity in Western Europe in recent years. And also, as I was saying earlier, a cavalier attitude towards religious freedom. You have a combination of all those factors, which is generating a new form of anti-Semitism. And I think it's something that Europe really needs to get a handle on before it spins out of control.
Some commentators have suggested that this is oddly some type of response to guilt.
Yes, it could be a very warped response to guilt. But I think another thing that's very interesting is that it could be a response to the way in which the Holocaust is talked about these days, because we have in Britain over the past few years, we've had something called Holocaust Memorial Day. There are more and more Holocaust museums. And this really ugly thing has emerged, which I can only describe as Holocaust envy, where you have these other groups, these other identities who say, well, what about our suffering in the past? What about our genocides? What about our wars? Why do you obsess over what happened to the Jews? So Doudon makes this argument all the time. He says, well, the Muslims have suffered in Bosnia and the Middle East. Why don't we commemorate their sufferings too? So I think there's an element of guilt, there's an element of shame about the fact that Europe lapsed into barbarism just 70 years ago in relation to the Jews. And there's also this really horrible kind of identity one-upmanship, this kind of clash of victimhoods, where you have people effectively saying, well, Jews aren't the only victims, we're victims too. And I think you can really see the danger of the politics of victimhood, the dangers of encouraging everyone to see themselves as a distinct identity that is victimized by the world, because it gives rise to this ugly clash between groups to see who can claim the mantle of supreme victim.
Well, Brendan, I think that's a depressing enough place to leave it for this month. Look, thanks very much. We'll talk about victims another day.
Thanks, Amanda.
Brendan O'Neill is the editor of Spiked in London and an occasional writer for The Australian. And as always, he'll be back next month with more from Europe. You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. In 1929, there was the Nile Water Agreement, then the Nile Basin Initiative, and then the Nile River Cooperative Framework, and more recently, the Entebbe Agreement. So where to next for what is believed to be the longest river in the world? When we think of war, we often think of weapons of mass destruction or arguments over property or ethnic disputes. It's not that often that we think of it in terms of water. But in fact, in 1988, the then Foreign Minister of Egypt, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, said he thought that the Nile would in fact be the cause of the next major war into which Egypt entered. Joining us now to talk about the Nile and water and conflict is Lauren Power. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Amanda.
Now, there's a paper called Strategic Analysis Paper discussing conflict on the Nile. You didn't write the paper, but I understand you worked closely with the author Jack D'Annunzio. It's a very interesting piece of work to talk about the Nile in terms of the potential conflict it might generate.
Yes, our program at Future Directions has been looking quite closely at conflict in the Nile Basin and Egyptian food and water security. And this is an extremely interesting and important topic to be speaking about, we think.
Well, I agree. I mean, we all were taught at school that it's the longest river in the world. 6,650 kilometres is a fair way, has 11 countries associated with it. I suspect the more interesting data is that there are 450 million people in the basin for the Nile, and that's just an introduction to the really interesting point, and that is that that population may well double in the next 25 years.
Yes, that's definitely the key point surrounding the issue. The paper looks at the potential for water wars amongst the countries of the Nile Basin, and it's a booming global population centre. If it was taken as a country on its own, it would be the third largest in the world behind India and China. And as you said, it could as much as double in the next or in the coming decades. Without active cooperation on the management of the Nile's water, this resource scarcity could lead to severe food and water insecurity in the region, which is already hungry, poor, and unstable. So I think, yeah, it's very important to assess the threat and likelihood that conflict could evolve from this situation.
Mm. Well, there were agreements struck with, you know, colonial United Kingdom back in the late 20s between Egypt and the UK, and then between Egypt and Sudan in 59. But things have moved on now, and we've got something called an Entebbe Agreement. You're more placed to tell me about this. So the limited understanding I have is that that brings in some upstream countries and gives them the opportunity to do a few things to take advantage of the Nile, like dams and irrigation. Is that roughly what the agreement does?
Absolutely, yeah. The colonial era agreements entitled Egypt to two-thirds of the flow of the Nile's water and Sudan the remaining third, even though almost none of the water originates in Egypt. And it also gave Egypt veto power on any developments along the Nile in upstream countries. So they could veto the construction of hydropower dams, crop irrigation projects. And Egypt sees this allocation as its historical right, but it's been widely suggested that perhaps it's more of a historical wrong. So the new agreement came about because of the Nile Basin Initiative, which began in the late 90s. And the Entebbe Agreement was formed in 2010. In 2011, the sixth state signed on, Burundi, giving it full recognition amongst international law. So it's essentially invalidated the previous colonial agreements. And it does allow the upstream states, where the waters of the Nile originate, to engage in large-scale water development programs. So the one that we look most closely at in the strategic analysis paper is Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The dam that's been constructed will be the largest in Africa, and it's been an extremely controversial project. Egypt suspects that its construction will lead to its water allocation decreasing, and they've been very active in voicing the quite aggressive rhetoric to the point that they would like the dam halted.
Yeah. Although other people have had a look at this and made an assessment that the GERD is not quite as attractive as the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam.
No.
But anyway, the GERD actually wouldn't have a significant impact on Egypt or Sudan.
Yeah, certainly there's been international...
The Tripartite Commission decided that.
Yeah, in May, the first findings of an international impact assessment process were... Well, they haven't been released publicly, but it's widely understood that the outcome is that there is little to no impact on Egypt's downstream water flow. Sudan, who would be equally affected, have, at the most recent tripartite agreement, broken with traditional alliances as such to side with Ethiopia over the project. They're acknowledging that there won't be any serious impacts to their water flow, which by implication would suggest that the same will be the case for Egypt. Egypt have been pretty unwilling to accept this, though. I think you have to imagine, if you're an Egyptian, Egypt is the Nile. There's such a long link between the Nile and Egypt's wealth and prosperity. Egypt was once one of the world's great agricultural civilizations, but now it imports 70% of its food needs. And at recent estimates, at least 17% of its population were food insecure or chronically hungry. The third of its food that Egypt does grow is produced on the banks of the Nile. And the Nile is Egypt's only major renewable water source. It provides 97% of their water supply. So as an Egyptian, they do believe that they have this inviolable historical right to the Nile. They depend on it entirely for their survival and for the entire existence of the state. And now they see that upstream nations want to undertake projects that could reduce that flow, the very lifeblood of Egypt. So Egypt's national pride is harmed and they see their very existence as threatened. So this has led to threats of war and amazingly aggressive rhetoric over recent decades and quite recently as well, when Ethiopia first diverted the Nile in May to begin the first phase of construction of the dam. The then President Morsi publicly stated that for any decrease in the waters of the Nile, even a single drop, the alternative would be Egyptian blood. So
that's hot stuff. That is hot
stuff. It certainly is.
But, you know, I'm a South Australian and we're at the bottom end of the Murray, and we do look at people in the eastern states helping themselves to that water and think, well, hold on, there are people down the other end. So in the end, all resources, but particularly water, needs to be understood by everybody that it's a shared resource. And
yes,
is there a possibility? In fact, it's really the only way out, isn't it? If everyone sits down together and works it out. Because Egypt does need the water. Other people are entitled to use water coming out. And if they get together and just get a bit smart and work together, perhaps instead of being, as Boutros-Ghali, I don't know about predicted, but pondered,
incorrectly. They did go to war after that.
Did they? Oh, okay, correctly. Over water?
No, incorrectly. With Israel.
Incorrectly, yes. But I mean, he still might be proved to be right if they go to war over water at some point in this issue of Egyptian blood. But maybe it will end up being the generator of greater peace, because they'll all come to their senses and realise, well, they have a common interest, and that's a reason to bring them to the table to talk about their common interests, that is, each having enough water. And so Boutros could be wrong.
Certainly. It's essential that Egypt realises that they're no longer in a position to hegemonically demand that the status quo is maintained. The geopolitical power structures in the Nile Basin have shifted considerably, and Egypt need to accept that their water flow will decrease in the future, and that the best way to handle that is active cooperation. The water sharing situation in the Nile Basin isn't just about conflict, it is about that potential for cooperation, because there's a large space between those two extremes that could be equally devastating. To avoid hazardous resource scarcity, active cooperation on resource management in the region is crucial, and there's great mutual benefits to be gained. Ethiopia, with this project, can provide an abundance of clean power. There's a large potential for large-scale agricultural development in Sudan that can increase food production for the region. There's definitely the possibility and the potential to manage the Nile's resources in a way that everybody wins. At this point, conflict is probably quite unlikely. It's simply too costly for everybody involved, and the benefits are quite unclear. But unfortunately, it looks as though cooperation from Egypt, at any rate, is equally unlikely. A number of the upstream states are managing quite well and seeing the mutual benefits, the pan-Africanism that can be promoted by this project and others like it. But Egypt seems... this is a point of national pride. It's perceived as a key strategic threat, and Egypt is yet to accept the necessity of cooperation.
They've got their own set of problems. Put water aside.
Yes.
Just say they had water gushing into the place and there was no issue with water. They've still got their own set of problems, and one can sympathise with someone being a leader in that country or amongst the leaders in that country and seeing this as just another big nasty issue they have to deal with. But you're right, obviously it has to be dealt with. And do you agree that perhaps the current political situation in Egypt is exacerbating this water issue at the moment?
Yeah, and they're quite closely interrelated, really. There's a very close relationship between food insecurity and political turmoil in Egypt. They have a long history of bread riots. Rising food insecurity was probably a driving cause of the last two revolutions. And food insecurity is rising at least in part because of this overdependence on the Nile's water. The government maintains an extensive food subsidy program to manage this threat, but it doesn't have the water to grow this food. It has to import it, and that's a major financial drain. The program is wasteful, costly. It's draining government resources, but it seems to be an essential political talisman.
Yeah. So the water really is not just another problem they have to solve. If they could solve that, they might actually reduce some of their internal tensions as well, because they'll have more
Absolutely.
Water, they'll be able to grow more food, and food prices will come down. I mean, For Australians, it's hard to understand people rioting over the price of bread. But
yes, but it's very prevalent in Egypt.
It is very, very real, real.
Certainly. And for democracy to succeed in Egypt, they need a strong economy that can provide growth and socio-political stability. For this, they're going to need extensive structural reforms, and that starts with the food subsidy system, which is related to water supply. But it's a difficult situation because for sustainable long-term development and the transition to democracy, Egypt does need to get rid of that food subsidy program. But to do so, it will probably cause rioting that will undermine political stability. So it's a very difficult catch-22 situation for the Egyptian government at present.
Lauren, this is an interesting issue, and we thank you for taking your time out to come and share some of this information with us. It's been a great pleasure, and we hope to talk to you again.
Thanks, Amanda.
Lauren Power is the manager of the Global Food and Water Crisis Research Program at Future Directions International. You're on RN and you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. And we're going to continue with our broad theme of water and conflict. This time, it's not over food, but fuel. And the growing belief that in the not-so-distant future, the main source of global energy reserves will not be in the Middle East, but in the Arctic. Well, if you're as old as me, even if you're a little bit younger, you might remember the Johnny Horton song, North to Alaska, the rush is on. You know, it might be happening again, for other reasons. We're joined again by Alan Dowd, who joined us last year, talking about Afghanistan, to talk about the Arctic and whether it is a hotspot. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here again, as always.
Now, Alan, it's a pretty brave assertion you make that in the not-too-distant future, and we'll come back to what not-too-distant means, that the main source of global energy reserves could shift from the Middle East to the Arctic. Do you really believe that?
Right. I think it's possible for a couple of reasons. One, we know that oil reserves in the Middle East are dwindling. That was a cause of great concern for much of the world in the 70s. And 80s, and then it revived in the 90s quite a bit. Of course, in the last 10 years, we've found a great amount of energy reserves in all across the Western Hemisphere, from off of Brazil all the way up through the United States and into Canada. And now energy reserves that have always been there, along and near the Arctic, are starting to be able to be accessed. So I think it's possible because the declining amount of oil and natural gas in the Middle East and the availability of energy up in the Arctic and around the Arctic. I do think it's possible.
Mm. Well, the Pentagon has apparently recently released an Arctic strategy, and that sort of makes clear just how much energy really is there and what that means for the security challenges.
Right. The Pentagon released its Arctic strategy in November. It's first of its kind, which is an indication that the Pentagon and military thinkers are concerned about what could happen in the Arctic and are preparing for that. Among some of the specifics, some of the numbers, if you want them, Amanda, are the Arctic holds an estimated 1,670 trillion, trillion with a T, cubic feet of natural gas and 90 billion barrels of oil. It's compared to the rest of the world, by the way, that means that the Arctic accounts for about 13% of the yet-to-be-discovered or tapped oil, and 30% of the yet-to-be-tapped natural gas. So it's a large amount of energy reserve,
well,
which
is
good news.
Well, it is, but of course every cloud has a silver lining and every bit of sunshine has a bit of grey behind, because
right.
This means an increased security risk. We understand that the Northwest Passage, which was previously regarded as a very hazardous shipping route, might now really open up and cut thousands of miles off the trip from Europe to Asia. And therefore, we can expect to see a lot more shipping there. That in itself is a security risk. And then you look at what the Russians are doing, building new warships precisely for the Arctic. You have to say to yourself, well, a bucket of money and a lot of energy usually attracts competing interests. Is that fair to say that's what's happening now?
I think that's fair to say, and one of the points that I've tried to make in writing about this issue for the last, more than 7 years, is that competition is one thing, and the drive to explore new and find new energy resources in the Arctic is good. That kind of competition will be good for consumers all around the world and good for those who depend on these energy sources. The challenge is, and this is the challenge that why the Pentagon is thinking about this, why the Canadian government and military and many of America's allies along the Arctic periphery are thinking about this, the challenge is to make sure the competition doesn't become or shift into strategic security misunderstandings and maybe even to conflict. That's the challenge, and that can be done. We have a playbook that we can draw from the Cold War on how to avoid things from becoming hot, and we have a growing amount of ways to deal with Russia that we didn't have, obviously, during the Cold War. So it's not inevitable that this will be a conflict, but I think competition is something that will happen. You mentioned, by the way, the Pentagon, and I've talked about it a couple times here in the last few minutes, but one of the Pentagon's real concerns, the Canadian military's real concerns, is not a Russian incursion or something, but what do these countries do when there's an environmental spill? You know, what do these countries do? And if they don't have cooperative ways of talking to each other, working with each other, clear lines on who helps where and when, environmental issues and environmental ecological problems could become, you know, disastrous if they can't work together. So those things are part of this change environment in the Arctic, and actually not necessarily related directly to security, but obviously security and defense issues are important too.
Well, of course, whenever there's a landmass, there are often arguments about who owns what. And
right.
As I understand, Russia has got a claim some people describe as dubious in relation
yeah.
to its own continental shelf or an alleged extension thereof. Is that going to cause or at least be a flashpoint for possible future conflict?
Well, it could be. It's already becoming a diplomatic flashpoint, Amanda. You know, Russia claims that they, and it's fairly dubious according to most experts, that they can have claims, legitimate claims over a large chunk of Arctic territory because of an underwater ridge that the Russian government says links to the Russian landmass. And they've made that clear that that's how they can stake their claim in controlling, they hope, a large chunk of the Arctic. Canada, as recently as last week, has challenged that and says, no, our tests, our explorations, actually many of them conducted with the United States, not surprisingly, to old friends and close friends, indicate that there's a connection of this ridge to Canadian territory. Now, this can be settled through international discussion, through things like the Arctic Council and through other vehicles. It doesn't mean it's going to be done by force, but when you hear Vladimir Putin talk, he speaks in terms of force. He says things like, we're open to dialogue, but defense of our geopolitical interests will be hard and consistent in the Arctic. And then he backs that up by really trying to beef up Russia's presence in the Arctic. So countries like Canada, United States, Norway, Denmark, Iceland really are now starting to raise their eyebrows.
Well, I think the United States has two icebreakers and Russia has quite a few more.
Right.
And since they cost nearly $1 billion each,
right.
You know, it's not inconsequential.
That's true. Russia has an estimated 24 what are called polar icebreakers. That's a big deal in asserting sovereign rights. The head of the U.S. Coast Guard says this is the main way that you assert sovereignty in a place like the Arctic is with icebreakers, because you can't do it through the air because airplanes can't fly at certain times of the year. You can't do it through normal shipping because normal ships can't cut through the ice through large chunks of the year. And it's virtually impossible to do it with just putting personnel or people down because the place is uninhabitable to a large degree. So one of the ways you assert sovereignty is with these icebreakers. The United States has two, one of which really is more of scientific, the other of which is very old, and the Russians have 25. And that's, you could say, it's coming at a bad time for the United States because we're in the midst of a great amount of military retrenchment right now and retooling. So this icebreaker gap, to reference the old missile gap of the Cold War era, could be a problem in the near future.
But you mentioned some of the allies of the United States that have interest in this area, because it's not just the United States alone, of course. There's quite a lot of NATO countries that have an interest. and you might include, even though they're not aligned, Sweden. So
right. There's
a great opportunity, if you like, for these countries to work together on this issue.
That's right. If they need to, as I referenced a moment ago, there is a playbook for these partners, countries like Norway, Denmark, Canada, the United States, Iceland, and then to a degree, like you mentioned, Sweden, which works with NATO on about everything. It's just not a member, technically. It acts and looks like a member. But these countries could come together and each play what I call niche roles in the Arctic if they wanted to. And already Norway has moved its military headquarters inside the Arctic Circle. They have a big Coast Guard headquarters north of the Arctic Circle. A lot of times Norway, Denmark, and Sweden are working together on joint maneuvers and Arctic cooperation. Denmark has an Arctic military command that they recently created, and they're kind of retooling their military to focus on Arctic issues. Canada has talked quite a bit about encroachment onto its sovereignty. It's very concerned about that, so it's opening training centers focused on the Arctic, trying to beef up some of its Arctic naval assets and trying to beef up its ability to monitor things, probably mostly with drones and sensors in the Arctic. And then the U.S. is partnering with several of those countries on different Arctic issues, Arctic maneuvers and such. So these countries, these friends, these allies, have the framework to work together and deal with Russia from a posture of strength. It doesn't have to be combative, but it seems if it's going to be, Russia is kind of starting down that path. And these countries are reacting to that, not being proactive or not even being provocative. It's Russia with its words and its actions that are kind of causing these countries to react.
Yeah, but hasn't NATO said it's got no intention of raising its presence and activities in the high north? I mean, that sort of sounds like a bit, well, we're going to back off and suggest that NATO is not a suitable vehicle for high-level cooperation on this or active cooperation, then perhaps these countries need to look at another formula. And I think you've referred to one called NORAD.
Right.
It might only apply to North America, United States
right.
and Canada, but could be the shape, if you like, of how some of these NATO countries and perhaps Sweden could operate under a rubric like that.
Right. You laid it out well, Amanda. It was disappointing and a bit perplexing. A few years ago, NATO officials said that the Arctic will be a future strategic interest of the alliance. And then Fogh Rasmussen, who's the current Secretary General, said we have no intention of raising our presence there. And that was perplexing, puzzling, and I think disappointing, because several NATO countries, especially the Danes and the Norwegians, have wanted to get NATO to play a role there in an allied, multilateral way. If they can't, there's no rule that says these partners can't work together bilaterally or quadrilaterally, if you want, and they could do so. There's something called, you mentioned NORAD, that's the North American Air Defense. It was created at the beginning of the Cold War to help Canada and the United States protect their shared airspace from Soviet Union. It has grown and evolved over the years. Now they work together on sea and maritime issues through NORAD. They obviously continue to work on air defense, including missile and air warplane defense. But because it's working on maritime issues now, and it has over the last several years, it really could be a foundation for these other countries to work together in Arctic maritime sovereignty issues, Arctic maritime security issues, and even Arctic maritime search and rescue, environmental issues too, because there's really no other structure available. NATO would have been perfect. Apparently there's no will for that among a lot of NATO except for these four or five countries. Maybe NORAD would work. The Arctic Council, which I mentioned, is not constructed to handle military and security issues. So until that changes, you know, there's going to have to be some other way that these partners work together. What I would be concerned about is Russia basically making its bids on the Arctic kind of a fait accompli, that it decides that because it says it's Arctic Russian territory, is because it possesses it, it justifies its claims, and because it claims it, it justifies its possession. We wouldn't want that to happen. I don't think any of the allies would want that.
No, and then it can say, well, its possession justifies its claim.
That's right.
Circling. That just seems to highlight the need for all the countries that have interests to get a focus on this. I mean, and start operating together, not just back off and leave Russia to take that which it would like to, you know, select before everyone else gets there.
That's right, man. And that's one thing I'm concerned about, because you mentioned in the piece I wrote that you can kind of start to see several of these countries basically going their own way and ad hocing their way through the Arctic challenge. And it would be much better for these partners who are old friends to work together, to have a rational and a rationalized way of approaching the security challenge that's going to develop in the Arctic, and to not reinvent the wheel for each other. If one country has some icebreakers, maybe another country wouldn't have to develop more. If one country has great drones and sensors, maybe another country wouldn't have to develop those. But it'd be better to do that than to ad hoc their way through this, as Russia really does try to kind of flex its muscle up there.
Alan, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, man, and have a great rest of your week.
Alan Dowd is a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute, and we will put a link to his article, The Arctic Becomes a Hotspot, on our website. And our website's where you need to go to hear the program again, or parts of it. Leave a comment or make a suggestion. That's abc.net.au/rn, and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Amanda Vanstone. And for any of you that don't know Johnny Horton's North to Alaska, here we go. Enjoy. Arrivederci.
Way up north, north to Alaska. Way up north, north to Alaska. North to Alaska. Go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska. Go north, the rush is on. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92. With George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold. Below that old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome, Sam crossed the majestic mountains to the valleys far below. He talked to his team of Huskies as he mushed on through the snow. With the northern lights a-running wild in the land of the midnight sun. Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 92.